Have you started eating your zucchini yet? Well, there's no need to begin locking your car doors while at church for fear of finding boat-sized cucurbits deposited on your front seat. Maybe your corn is not as high as an elephant's eye, but ankle high would be about par for this time of year. Greens like spinach are beginning to bolt, but don't worry, you'll be able to plant another crop for fall eating. Dan Dross, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, is in studio for the hour. Among other topics, we'll discuss the nutrients that your vegetables need right now for proper growth and maximum fruiting potential. Also today, learn about the habits of hummingbirds in Utah, including how the warming climate is affecting their food source and what you can do to encourage hummingbirds in your yard. All this today on Access Utah, but first the news. Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go to UPR and click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah, and you can email us a question. Or you can also tweet us a question if you'd like to do it at hashtag AUGarden. And a lot of different ways to contact us, but we'd love to hear from you. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here. You know, it's always better when we get those phone calls because it adds a lot to the conversation. And I know that a lot of people that I talk to say they just like to hear me talk, but I get a little tired of that. I'd rather have someone throw me a curveball and see if I can hit it out of the park.
You must have a question. So we'd love to hear from you first at the beginning of the program instead of waiting until the end, because the time does go by very quickly. I was in the garden this morning, actually up early before dawn, about 5:45, headed out to the garden because I just couldn't stop thinking about all these different plants that I needed to get watered. I was worried about making sure they had enough moisture. So why don't we start talking about, right here at the beginning of the program, how important moisture and consistent moisture is. It's been 3 weeks since measurable precipitation in northern Utah, so that's quite a bit of time in between if you're waiting for Mother Nature to help out.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of us realize that we live in a climate that's relatively dry, and so while we periodically get these storms, you know, it might be in Hyde Park, but it might not be in Logan. That's oftentimes the things that happen to us. And, you know, the key things right now that we're trying to accomplish is that as we move into these higher temperature conditions, for those crops that we planted out in the early spring, which are kind of the remnants of our cool season crops, and in particular things like our lettuce and our spinach and radishes and those kinds of things, that what we find is as we move into warmer temperatures, that as it gets hotter, the demand for moisture goes up. But also if they come under stress, we're going to start to see that radishes start to flower, spinach starts to go to seed. Lettuce may do exactly the same thing because it's responding to the day length. And June 20, you have to remember, is the longest day of the year.
No.
Don't say that. Yes, it is the longest day, and that only means one thing. We're on our way back toward, shorter days again. And so that triggering response within the plant can be accelerated to flower. That triggering response can be accelerated by both temperature and by stress. And the stress that we have to be worried about, particularly as it gets a little drier, is are we keeping our soil moisture levels at the optimum and allow those plants to deal with whatever the environmental conditions are like. Now, it was warm early. It hasn't been excessively hot. You know, we had a pretty warm day throughout the state yesterday. Supposed to be warm again today, cool off a little as a front comes through, then a little warmer again toward the weekend. And it's those kind of conditions that, you know, make it a little bit difficult to actually predict how much moisture a plant will need. But what we want to do is think about the size of our plants, and that kind of is an indicator of rooting depth. And then when we add water, we want to make sure that that whole profile is moist. And so at this time of the year, we should probably be watering one good irrigation a week. And if you're on water turns, well, you're kind of forced to do that. But if you have an irrigation system that's tied into a pressurized system where you can collect water and use it as you see fit, or if you are working off a culinary water, you know, you still really need to be about one good irrigation a week where we're applying about an inch of water in that event. And if we're watering every day, like I see the grass across the street from me, and I won't say too much about the excess amount of water, but that water runs every morning. It runs for more than a half hour, and it's 7 days a week, and it'll be like that for the rest of the year. And it's way too much water for these plants.
It's just nuts. I know it's nuts that you wouldn't be more on top of knowing exactly what you should do. I mean, that's...
Well, I think it's easy for us. We are so used to technology, and we'll just put it on the clock, and it'll do it, and then I don't have to worry about it. And I don't think it's too much. That's what you may say. You don't really know how much is going on, and yet, you know, you're, you know, kind of being wasteful. And certainly, while we had last year a really good water year, this year was not the best. And while the reservoirs are full, the season started early, irrigating started early, and that may put pressure on us later in the year. So if we're going to do it for our vegetable garden, we want to ensure that we get the optimal amount of productivity out of it, but that requires us also to be able to apply the correct amount of water for the type of plant that we're growing and for the stage that it's at. So our illustration of the leafy vegetables, things like spinach or lettuce or radishes and some of those kind of short-statured plants, you know, their rooting depth is about the same depth as they are tall. And so, you know, you want to be applying water to fill that profile and keep it on the moist end but not on the wet end. So more than an inch of water is going to be too much. Now, we've got other crops that are flowering at the time. And so you said to me before we came on air, my peas have been exceptionally good this year. Well, the temperatures have been quite appropriate for them. You know, days no more than 80 degrees, a few warmer ones, but for the most part, cool night temperatures. Those are perfect for those peas. But if they're flowering heavy right now, the one thing that can happen is that if we don't supply them with sufficient moisture, then you're going to get, you know, less pod production than you would imagine. So, you know, those plants, once again, they maybe stand 12 inches or, you know, 14 inches tall. You need to fill that profile again. Okay, he's indicating to me they're like 2 feet tall up then. So you're going to have to figure that your rooting depth is at least a foot and a half. And so you want to fill that profile, and they may actually need more water than an inch during the week, because an inch is kind of that average number that we use. They might need a little bit more, because what you want to do is keep them quite productive. But by the same token with peas, they're quite susceptible to some of the root rot. So if we're watering a couple times during the week, that's way too much moisture for them, and they become less productive as a result of those add excess watering.
Okay, so what I've typically done with my peas is I would flood irrigate.
Yep.
And so my soil is a little bit clay, so 7 to 8 days in between watering is what I would typically do. Is that enough for peas?
Well, you know, it probably is. You think there, if you feel your productivity has been good, you probably got it right. The question is, you know, the duration of the water being put into the garden along that row. So how long does it stay in the furrow? Is that an hour? Is that a couple hours? Does it take to kind of fill that profile? Those are the difficult things that one needs to ascertain, and why it becomes really hard for us, and why when you look around, well, how much should I water my vegetable garden? You don't see that publication, because for a sandy soil, you may only need to introduce the water for an hour, and you'll fill that profile up because it penetrates really rapidly. And your stream through the furrow can be quite fast. If you're in a heavy soil, the infiltration rate is very, very much different. It's a lot slower, so you don't want to introduce a very fast stream. You want it just kind of trickle in there, and you may actually need to leave it for a longer period of time in order to get the profile wet.
Now, I've noticed that, in at least in my garden, when I do that deep watering with the irrigation, it gets down so far that the ground itself at the top it dries out fairly quick, but you can tell that there's moisture there, like it's almost coming back up. Does that make sense?
And it does. You know, we say that there's a capillary rise that occurs in soils as well. That occurs quite regularly. Plants will pull it up, so to speak, as well. And there's a natural kind of wetting and drying that occurs over the course of the day due to the environmental conditions that it's exposed to. Now, those are fairly small. They're measurable, but, you know, are they important enough? You know, I think that's the biggest problem that most of our gardeners have, is it's a question of how much do I need to water based on the stage of growth that the plant's at and what the environmental conditions are like. And that oftentimes that's where the biggest problem occurs each year in the vegetable garden, either that you're underwatering and the plants aren't as productive as you would like them to be, or you're just overwatering and the plants aren't doing as well simply because they're under some stress due to excess water. In other words, they're in apoxic conditions where you have flooded and you have no air or less air in the soil than you need for those roots to function effectively, because you are putting it on, you know, in small bursts. Or what you do is you force all the plants to grow kind of roots in the shallow zone because you're just pulsing it on regularly, like the watering going on across the road from me, where a little bit goes on every day and they do it every day. And the plants never really get rooted very well through the whole soil. And therefore, when a stress event comes on, you know, we run out of water or we forget to water or we go on a holiday or something like that, and then we see that those plants are suffering because their root system isn't very large. So it's irrigation is one of the harder things for us to try to convey that to the listening audience, and it's also hard for us to kind of describe it in many ways because you just can't do it in a few words. It takes a pretty long thesis, so to speak, of what's happening.
So as I was looking at my parsnips, they're probably about that tall. Does that mean that the root down below is getting that big? I mean, that tall, meaning about a foot.
Well, interestingly enough, in things like carrots and parsnips and things like that, if you look at their growth during the first 30 days after they emerge, you know, top growth is relatively slow, but root growth is almost at its maximum by the end of that 30 days. So your parsnips, if the height of your parsnip is a foot tall right now, the root system is probably in the 1 to 1.5 foot depth range. And you've got fine roots that are really deep. But the part that will fill out, that you'll dig up later and consume, you know, is in the top 12 inches.
But I need to make sure that soil is being... water's
wetted,
penetrating a foot and a half.
Yes, exactly. You want to utilize that whole space because that plant has got these fine roots down there. And if we allow that bottom part of the soil to dry out because I'm not putting so much on, then, you know, it actually impacts how well that root's going to grow and fill out as the season progresses. And you've got quite a long time yet before those parsnips are really going to start to expand. And so you've got to be thinking about those types of things. So we've talked a little bit about some of those cool weather crops, you know, and as we're thinking about our warmer weather crops, things like our melons and our squashes and our sweet corn and our tomatoes and peppers, you know, most of those plants yet are fairly small unless we went through some extraordinary efforts to put row covers over top of them or a wall of waters around them. We may have tomato plants that we only planted about 3 or 4 weeks ago and that are really just starting to take off, and you might be seeing your first blooms on them. Some people I know already have some fruiting that's occurring because they buy larger plants. Well, all of those plants then are going to need to be sure that we water them regularly, and your inch may not be enough for those types right now, particularly if you're already coming in bloom. And we experienced these warm temperatures that we had. You know, it was about 88 at my house yesterday. You know, if you're in the Salt Lake Valley, it was well into the 90s. If you're down in Moab or in St. George listening today, you know what you're up against. You know, you really need to be watering more times each week to keep that profile moist so that those plants can adhere to that stressful environment, because what we see in things like peppers and tomatoes and in melons and in cucumbers and in squash, when our temperatures get up above about 90 to 95 degrees in that range and those plants come under stress, the first organ on the plant that is impacted by that is the flower. And we see an increased incidence in blossom end rot as a result of that. So that's that black spot that shows up on the base of the tomato fruit or a spot on the base of the pepper fruit. Or we'll see cucumbers that don't fill out normally and they're a little bit more pointed in shape, or they may, you know, have kind of a darker green color to them and they may have more bitter flavors when we do consume them. Those are those cucurbitaceans, which are compounds that are stress related within the plant. So, you know, keeping those plants more hydrated will really help to get them through these higher temperatures that we're going to experience. And as we move into July, July 24 is the week of that is the hottest week of the year in northern Utah. Well, already in Moab and in St. George, you're starting to approach them. Early July until the middle of August is the hottest time. So you have like 6 weeks that you have to contend with these excessively high temperatures, and it makes it a challenge for those plants to deal with that kind of stress. And watering is one way for us to try and accomplish that. And certainly in those environments that have these higher temperatures, you know, going to a drip irrigation system where you can put on a little bit of water every day and concentrate it around those plants, it kind of goes against what we've talked about. Or if we do overhead irrigation, the bigger problem that we have is so much of it evaporates. Well, we do know that evaporative cooling can be a useful technique, and I know some gardeners that do that. They say, well, getting fresh local tomatoes rather than those green cardboardy things that I buy in the grocery store all the time, I really want these local ones, so I am going to pay for a little bit more water and use it to evaporatively try to cool those plants so that those flowers set. So the flower on it is the thing that we're interested in. And yet, by the same token, we have to maintain the structure of the plant, and that takes water. And when a plant is under stress, it preferentially starts to move water to leaves at the expense of the flowers and the fruits. So the fruits actually start to get dried out a little bit, and then compounds within them can build up, and that's why the cucumber tastes more bitter, or the squash is not quite like we would expect it to be, or the tomato is a little leathery on the skin. You know, it's really firm and hard, and you kind of go, why is it that way and not soft like I'm expecting it? Those are all symptoms of the plant that's under stress.
Would you say that most vegetables prefer consistent moisture? They don't like the drying out, then getting wet and drying out again?
Yeah, I would say that's probably true for all of them except the melon family, because what we find is if we can dry them out a little bit, particularly as they ripen, and it's a really tricky thing to do, and we're not talking about a lot of drying, it only takes a little bit, that what the plant does, as I said, it moves water out of the fruit toward the leaf, and the net effect of that in a watermelon or in a cantaloupe or in a honeydew is an increase in the sugar concentration within the fruit. And to me, that's why they taste so much better when you pull them out of your garden than the ones you buy in the grocery store, because they're just saying, well, how do we sell watermelons? We sell them by weight. So what weighs a lot? Water weighs a lot. So we make sure that they're well hydrated when we pick them. And that dilutes out the sugars, and that's why oftentimes it's hard to find a really good watermelon when we go to, you know, our regular food outlet to purchase them. And yet when we go to travel through Green River or we go to the farmer's market and we converse with and interact with and purchase fruits from one of our local growers who understands these concepts, what he tends to try and do is just dry them out a little bit, concentrate those sugars. Yeah, you sacrifice a little bit of weight, but you get a customer that goes, wow, that's what a watermelon should taste like. That's what a cantaloupe should taste like. I am so excited about that, that they come back again week after week to buy their product from him. And that's what he's trying to sell. I have a quality product that has the flavors and the textures that I want to experience. And the same with tomatoes and those types of things. Why we like local so well, and why people are starting to demand more and more local produce, because the local growers know what it takes to grow it. And the guys that are big commercial growers someplace else that have to ship them all the way across the country, they do understand what it takes to grow a good product, but they are under different constraints. I need to be able to move product from A to B. I can't have it too ripe when it's in transit, like a tomato, so therefore I pick it a little less mature, so it doesn't have the full acids and sugars that I would like. And as a result of that, you know, the quality that I get in my local store is not nearly the same as if I buy it from one of my local producers or if I grow it in my own garden. And that's why so many gardeners in this country are doing what they do every day and spending the time there. You can certainly purchase a lot more food at a lower cost, but it's never the same. I'm always looking for that first ripe tomato, and that's what I live for. And the rest of the year, yeah, I kind of eat them sometimes, but most of the time I just forego it until tomato season, then we eat tomatoes at every meal.
So when you're talking about withholding moisture from your melons, you're not talking about doing the main part of the growing season. You're talking about once those melons have begun to ripen.
They're full size. Yeah. So what you want is to keep them moist, uniformly moist. So you want to maintain, you know, soil moisture levels that are up near field capacity, all the way up to the point that they're full size. And then as, you know, in subsequent weeks, we'll talk a little bit more about melon ripening, because we're still too early to talk about that aspect of it. But when we get up to that full size, then that's when you start to, you know, take a little bit of that moisture away to put them under just a wee bit of stress. And we're not talking just shut the water off. We're talking, you know, a little bit less in order for the plant to say, okay, I need a little bit more water for my leaves. I'm going to take it from my fruit, and that's going to concentrate the sugar. But until then, no, we want to keep them fully hydrated.
Now, there are some vegetables that you don't want to water, especially don't want to water too much, and I'm thinking of asparagus.
Yes.
Since you're the world expert on asparagus, tell the audience then how they should water their asparagus, because it's different than I, you know, the way I grew up watering it. It's just like, well, just every week along with my irrigation.
Yeah.
But I think I was rotting the crowns.
And you were, and that's often what happens. And so with asparagus, I mean, we've just finished the asparagus harvest season, the last of the commercial growers that I know of. Quit cutting it. That's right. They, you know, by the middle of June is probably the absolute latest. This year, because we started around the 1st of April, it was very early when we started finding asparagus locally. And so you want about 8 to 10 weeks. So all of April, all of May, about the middle of June if you're in a good environment. And that would be, you know, like the Salt Lake area, you know, down Moab or St. George area, some of those kinds. That's how long. Here in northern Utah, Box Elder, you know, in Cache counties and stuff, maybe 8 weeks is all we would harvest. So we would be done about the 1st of June. And then what you want to do is you want to fill that profile. So you want to irrigate it, and you want to irrigate it heavily and deeply, and then not irrigate it again for about 3 weeks. And about every 3 weeks now for the remainder of this growing season until about the first week of September. And then we don't irrigate it anymore. Mm. So we're kind of getting it up and growing. We're keeping it hydrated, but we're also allowing the plant to utilize some of that moisture, because the crown itself or the growing points and the root system don't like to be super wet. And if you're watering it every week like you're watering the rest of your garden, that just isn't the best for this plant. Now, your other perennials like rhubarb, you know, it was pretty dry this spring, and, you know, we had a really nice rhubarb crop. But then we also had to irrigate it nearly every week because it has a shallower root system, and now it's starting to go dormant. It's starting to senesce off, and we're done harvesting our rhubarb as well. And we're going to kind of let it dry itself out. And then come July, I'm not going to worry about watering it anymore. I really don't want it to be actively growing. I kind of want it to be sitting quietly, waiting for the moisture to come next spring when that crop is going to come off again. And I heard that some people found artichokes, another perennial, but which we grow as an annual. Those act more like rhubarb, but the trick with an artichoke is that you just need to water it a lot. So you should water it like the rest of the garden, because that plant really has a very, very shallow root system, and you want to keep it well hydrated so that the plant grows vigorously. And we're also, remember, we're interested in a flower bud. And just like our tomato plant, if I stress the plant, the flower buds don't form as we would like, or they tend to be too small, and then you just don't get the level of productivity. So as that plant begins to show those flower buds, you really want to give it a lot of water, and you may actually have to water it two times a week in order to get it enough water so that those flower buds fill out and produce the kind of chokes that we often see in the grocery store. Which are much, much larger, and that's due to the fact that they just get watered an awful lot.
Well, I have to say that this year's asparagus has been the best, and I think it's because I finally caught the vision. I didn't plant it too deep. I've been watering it about once every 3 weeks pretty deeply, and so that was through last year. And then so this year...
You had a great crop.
I had a great crop. Yeah. So I want to plant two more rows.
Oh, well, you know, really next good. Spring, you know, get the site prepared this year. You know, make sure you get all the bindweed out of it and all the quack grass and all those other nasty perennial weeds that we have floating around. And yeah, go
we'll
for it.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program. You've been listening to Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. To call in with your questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah. So you can email us a link. And then you can also tweet us a question at #AUGarden. So stay tuned. Right now you'll hear the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with Dan Drost.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
The hummingbird feeders at Stokes Nature Center are a busy place this time of year. Little bullets of metallic green zoom in and out, jockeying for position, while others rest or await their turn in the branches of nearby box elder trees. The birds are a great source of wonder and amusement for staff and guests alike. June signals the start of nesting season for Utah hummingbirds. At this point in the year, the birds have mainly recovered from their lengthy migrations from places as far away as Central America and are ready to focus on their next set of challenges, establishing a territory, courtship, mating, and rearing young. Hummingbird nests are a wonder all their own. Tiny and cup-like, they are generally found affixed to small branches near riparian areas. Nests are constructed primarily of plant materials, and are lined with plant down, such as the fluffy seeds produced by cottonwood trees. Materials used on the exterior of the nest vary from species to species. Black-chinned hummingbirds use leaves and flowers, while broad-tailed hummingbirds are partial to decorating with lichens or shredded bark. Regardless of the exterior appearance, hummingbird nests have one important material in common: spider webs. Hummingbirds collect the webs and use them to plaster the outside of the nest, which serves two important purposes: acting as a glue that holds nest materials together, while at the same time providing some flexibility that allows the nest to stretch and grow with the developing young. Nests are occasionally constructed on the foundation of last year's home, and two eggs, around half an inch in length, are laid and incubated by the female for about 16 days before hatching. Young will fledge and join their mother at your backyard feeder about 20 days later. If nesting is successful, the family migrates south in the fall and will return to the same general area next May. Finding food in early spring, however, is becoming more of a challenge each year to hummingbirds in the American West. A recent study published in the journal Ecology shows that hummingbird migrations and spring flower blooms are becoming out of sync. Broad-tailed hummingbirds in particular rely upon the nectar of petite yellow glacier lilies, one of the first flowers to bloom in spring. Scientists have found that due to global temperature increases, glacier lilies are blooming about 17 days earlier than they did in the 1970s. The birds, however, haven't altered their migration timing, so often arrive to find the flowers already in full swing. If this trend continues, scientists predict that within the next 20 years, the birds could miss the glacier lily bloom entirely. Hope lies in the hummingbird's ability to adapt, either by migrating farther north to places where the lilies bloom later, or shifting their own migration time to match the changing bloom dates. Photos of glacier lilies, Utah hummingbirds, and their nests can be found on our website, www.wildaboututah.org. Thank you to the Rocky Mountain Power Foundation for supporting the research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For the Stokes Nature Center and Wild About Utah, this is Andrea Liberator.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Hello and welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, is my guest. And we're waiting for your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then click on the Access Utah link to send us your question. We do have three questions to start out with. The first one is from John in Ogden. Hi, John. How can we help?
You're really low on iron in my soil. My strawberries are suffering, and I read about adding fish emulsion with blackstrap molasses. Wondering if Dan knows anything about that.
Well, you know, I don't know what's in blackstrap molasses. The fish emulsions, I mean, if you go on the ones that are available and you look at them, they should have a nutrient percentage that's there. So they tend to be have a little bit of nitrogen, some phosphorus, some potash. They may also have some iron. What we do with ours is we actually get some chelated iron and we inject that through our irrigation system. Most of our strawberries are on drip, but you could just fill a watering can with some of that and sprinkle it over top of the row, and that will help get the color back into those, because we're seeing it as well. And so we've just kind of in our fertility program for our strawberries always get some iron injected into the system. And because those plants are cropping pretty heavy right now, they're under a lot of stress, we have to water a little bit more. And as we water a little bit more, that's one of the problems that we end up seeing is iron chlorosis showing up.
Okay.
So, I don't know what's in the molasses. I just don't know what's in that. So that unless I research it more, I just don't have that information available here. In terms of the fish emulsion, that's a nice slow-release fertilizer that has low nutrients in it, and what it does is constantly feed it. That's what we basically do. We have about a liquid feed that we just put on every time we water, and we're watering because the crop load on strawberries and our research work this year is so heavy, we've been watering nearly every day, and we're actually feeding a little bit every day, and iron becomes a component of that. So either go out and get some chelated material if you need to get a fast response, or when you look at some of those organic forms of fertilizer, if you're into the organic thing, you need to read the label carefully and make sure that there's iron in it.
All right. I think what the gentleman mentioned was that it was an article on the internet, and he said that it causes the soil to become more acid.
Yeah, well, John, the problem that we have in our soils is that our soils have such a high pH to start with. I know of some of our farmers that are injecting sulfur in their system to try and reduce the acid, to make the soil more acid and get it back toward neutral.
Mm-hmm.
they put on so much that when we do the numbers for them, they finally realize that it's just not economic to do it. So, you know, you're going to live with the pH that you have to have. Now what you need to be able to do is say, okay, change my watering practices a little, feed a little bit more regularly, kind of work through some of those other issues. And certainly one of the things that you can, if you're having some problems, you know, head down to the Ogden Botanical Center. They have individuals there that can help you work through some of those things and kind of take your soil and create a recipe for you so that you're more successful.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John, for
calling.
Thanks,
John. I was just thinking you'd have to put on so much molasses, that blackstrap molasses, if that were true, you'd just be pretty gooey out in the garden.
I like molasses cookies more than I like, you know, molasses in my soil. Now, you know, some of the things there are these remedies that if you feel that you don't have enough microbial activity, and sometimes our soils tend to be a little bit low in that, sometimes putting in these kind of tonics, so to speak, that have some sugar in them, what that does is it helps microbial bloom. And that microbial bloom then helps with releasing nutrients within the soil. But the quantity that it takes to do those kinds of things, you know, varies depending on your soil. You know, there's a lot more information that I would need from John. I'd like to really see his soil test, you know, and if he hasn't done a soil test in his garden recently, that would be a good place to start, and then use that information and go to your local cooperative extension office where you have someone help you interpret what that means, and then what they can do is start to suggest remedies to kind of make sure that we have enough of any of the elements into the soil and what you could put on that would be a good source that will supply it. Now, the other thing, when we see iron chlorosis, it's a little unusual if you're doing a good job of irrigating, but if you're watering heavily, watering too regularly, keeping a wet environment, you start seeing iron chlorosis showing up in the environment. And oftentimes that's what goes on with strawberries, and that's why we see them, because we're dealing with lots of leaf area, we're dealing with heavy fruit loads, and we want to size those fruits up. And so you need to put a little extra water on them, and the root system is very shallow, so it's a little too wet maybe there, but we're doing it to compensate for something else. And we want that berry size. We can pick smaller berries, but it's easier to pick bigger berries. So you need the water to do that, but you need the nutrients to do that. And then the next thing that shows up is your iron chlorosis. So that's when you need to actually supplement with some chelate. And you know, that can work really, really well.
Weeks Berry Farm in Paradise, I went out there a couple of years ago to see how they're growing blueberries, because it's just not a crop that the average person is going to be able to do. And their pH is a little bit lower anyway, but they've got so much sulfur in the ground that the ground is yellow.
Yeah.
And so apparently for them, they've found that the economics it's still good because people want to have locally grown blueberries, but they have to do so much.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the price that you have to pay for that. That's a lot. And you give the Weeks some credit. You know, they said, "Well, there's a market demand." And then he's also using value-added products, like he's making blueberry juices and jams, which, you know, helps to add value to just a commodity, which is a blueberry. And so, you know, he's going to go to extraordinary lengths to do these types of things. And you got to give the man kudos for those types of
things.
And
he's found a way to do it.
But he has to do a tremendous amount of modification. And interestingly enough, when we put situations and we put a lot of sulfur into our soil to try and lower the pH, and then what do? We add water back into the system to keep our plants growing, and our water has lots of calcium in it, and so that ties up the sulfur, and it also is fairly pH neutral or above. So what we're doing is adding something in that actually raises the pH again. You know, it's just a constant battle. So people that say, "Well, I want to change the pH of my soil," it's not worth it. It's better to learn how to work with what you already have and not do major modifications to it. Just try and improve it, and you'll be much, much more successful.
Our next caller is from Logan. We have Michael. Thanks for holding on, Michael. How can we help?
Yes, I have a question on my yard. It has quite a bit of morning glory, and I'm wondering what is the most effective way to kill it and totally eliminate it from the yard. I hear horror stories about it just taking over yards and almost impossible to kill. That's what
and,
method that you
and they're all true.
Yeah, and Michael, you've heard the thing. That's why I said earlier when I was talking to Brian here, he said, well, I want to plant more asparagus. And I said, well, perennial plants, you know, we need to make sure that we control all of those perennial weeds. And morning glory is one of those. And asparagus is one of those. And turf grass is one of those. And so the types of things that you need to go through is one of these weed and feed regimes that starts out early in the year with fertilizer, because that'll help the grass grow. It also helps the morning glory grow. But what you're trying to do is get the grass to outcompete the weed, and then at some point in the season, there's going to be some topical herbicides that you're going to have to put on, and those are critical at certain times of the year, particularly when the morning glory is trying to put energy back down into the root system. So things like 2,4-D or products that have 2,4-D in it. There is a range of different herbicides that are out there that are available at our garden centers to try and control this. And you're just going to have to be diligent, and you're going to have to apply it with some regularity. Now, if you're opposed to the use of herbicides, then the only real way to kind of control it is to let the grass grow big, tall. Don't mow it too short, because then the morning glory has more as a better competitive advantage. You want to outcompete it by having the grass outcompete it. And that means usually a little bit more fertilizer and a little bit more water. And if you're organic, you may say, well, I'm opposed to fertilizer as well. So now you just really, through other management practices, try to get that grass to outcompete the stuff. And it's a hard, hard weed to control.
And if my grass is pretty much fine, I don't have it in my grass too bad. It's just the garden where I have my vegetables.
Okay.
And I'll use anything that will get rid of it. I mean, the 2,4-D is the best thing to get rid of it. I'll use that.
Yeah, well, okay, if you're not opposed to doing that, however, let me put a qualifier. You know, when you're dealing with your vegetable garden, many of our vegetables are very, very susceptible to 2,4-D damage as well. So if you've got tomatoes growing out there, if you have peppers, if you have melons and squash and cucumbers, if you have beans, if you have some of our leafy greens, and you start applying 2,4-D, even in spot applications just on the morning glory, what you end up finding is that during the heat of the day, that compound also kind of goes into the gaseous form, and then it gets into all these other veggies, and then they aren't productive. And the organs that show it up are new leaves, new flowers, all of those things start to fall off the plant and don't do very well. So what you need to do this year to try and control morning glory is, after you decide you're done with your vegetable garden and you've done fighting it for the year, then you go in and you spray some 2,4-D on it so that gets down into the root system. And then next spring, you need to use things like some plastic mulch underneath your melons and under your tomatoes and under your squash and peppers. What that will do is it'll keep the morning glory from growing in those rows, and then it's just judicious efforts in the rest of your veggie garden to try and keep them out through cultivation and roguing. And, you know, don't throw these things into your compost pile. Put them in the green waste and send them off someplace to get composted else. Be careful when you purchase compost, if you buy compost, because if it's not decomposed well, you're going to get morning glory roots, and you're just going to be bringing it back into your system anyway. You know, I can empathize with what you're up against, because this is probably the biggest garden problem that we have, other than some of the perennial grasses. It's morning glory. And it's
then
just...
I have one question. I'm not sure if you heard. I did some research on the internet,
yeah.
And I think Colorado, they came up, or I guess they found that there's this one mite or something that was over in Europe that
yep.
just pertain to just eating the morning glory and the root system. Have you heard about it?
Yes, we have. And I don't know, you know, there's all kinds of regulations about importing things into states and doing that things. And I don't know whether they've gotten around to the point where they're actually growing these things and allowing people to purchase them and for release in their area. You know, the key thing with those is, you know, in order to keep the mite around, you got to have some morning glory. And if you completely eradicate it, it's going to go someplace else. And so you're always going to have a little bit of morning glory that you're going to have to fight, even if you're going to use a biocontrol like these insects.
Okay. Well, appreciate your help. Thank
well,
you very much.
Well, we wish you the best and, you know, get at it this year and then, you know, call us back in the subsequent shows and tell us how you've been making out with this, and we can give you more suggestions as we go along.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, wait till the fall.
That's what I found.
You know, I've sprayed in the summer before and when there's not other plants around it and don't get near the effective control with bindweed as I do when I wait till the fall.
What the bindweed does is during the rest of the year, it's kind of growing out new leaves and it's not transporting a lot of materials down to the root system. And that root system is where we really need to get these chemicals. So, you know, a couple things that are effective is, you know, these, you know, like Roundup materials will work. They slow acting compared to a lot of things. It's less dangerous in your vegetable garden, Roundup is, but what it does is it'll burn the leaves back, and then it forces the root to grow more leaves, and then you burn it back another time, and then it grows more leaves. And what you're trying to do is deplete the root system of the energy that it has, and then in the autumn, when it starts to translocate energy from the leaves back down into the root system, and that usually starts about mid-August and into mid-September during that time frame, that's when you want to treat it with some 2,4-D type materials, because then that stuff gets sucked down into the root system and then it kills the root, because you really need to get at the root of the problem, and the root of the problem is where bindweed functions, and that's the only way to do it. And then it takes you couple years usually to knock it out, because the types of chemicals that we have available for us in the home vegetable garden aren't really as effective as the other types of vegetables that we have in larger cropping systems. But 2,4-D works pretty good, but you got to be really careful, because if you start applying in August and you got a full tomato crop on and a full pepper crop on and you got watermelons set and trying to grow and you get that gas into the other veggies that we have, you know, it really hammers the production on the thing. So it's not one that I often will recommend unless, you know, the gardener is really desperate and said, I just can't stay on top of this. What do I need to do?
So do you wait until it's been, the frost has come on? I mean, what's the signal for the morning glory that's to start pulling things down?
Well, it's just as it's, really, it's when it's flowering heavy, and sometimes you'll actually see seed setting on the thing, you know, so when it starts to flower, and you're starting to see it flower, but it's still a little bit too early. Usually late July at the earliest. I always get mine in late August into early and mid-September. Mm-hmm. If you start getting frosts on it, it's almost to the point where it doesn't, it's kind of going to sleep on its own, and it's not as effective. So I try in that August-September window.
Okay, we have an online question from Jim in Logan. He says, Dan, and this is kind of related to something we talked about early in the program, does Extension have a guide for irrigation for the home gardener? I don't have a large garden and so have only a few plants with a large variety. Is there a good compromise for irrigation so I don't have to generate a spreadsheet, an elaborate alarm system to get to go to my garden several times a day?
Thank you for making me smile, Jim. I always enjoy that when I get these kinds of questions.
And Jim would do it. I know Jim. He would do a spreadsheet.
I know. Yeah, and I appreciate that. We have a couple pseudo-guides. They're not as effective as we would like. I've kind of hesitated putting one together because it's really hard to be specific enough for them, because each vegetable, even though we try to lump them together, has kind of unique requirements and unique time periods in which water needs to be done. And so I wouldn't advocate the spreadsheet, you know, if you only have a few plants. I would try to water kind of based more on what the stress level is like for a particular week. And in some of the papers, you can get a value called evapotranspiration value, an ET value. And it will, during the heat of summer, generally be about a quarter of an inch a day is what the plants are using water-wise. And so as you think about that, if you think of 7 days, that means in the heat of the summer, we need about an inch and a half to an inch and three quarters of water, once again, depending on your soil type. And that's where, you know, Jim didn't even provide me enough information. I don't know whether he's got a sandy soil, he's got a heavy soil, you know, how much organic matter he's been adding over the years, you know, how shallow it is or how deep it is. I live up by the Logan Temple. I've got about 8 inches in some places in my yard, and other places I always have dry patches in my grass, and Dawn always complains, get rid of that dry patch. And I say, well, I only have about 2 or 3 inches of soil there. That's all that's in that location before it goes into this gravelly area. So either I overwater one area or I underwater another area, and I'd rather underwater than I would overwater. So you know, kind of if you can find those ET values, and sometimes you need to go to the Climate Center type things, to the website that the Climate Center has, and they actually will publish ET values. You can find those in there for that. And then you just kind of say to yourself, just look at the historics for your particular location and say, oh yeah, all of July, it averages out to about a quarter of an inch a day. So then when you're thinking about irrigation, we want to put on water at about an inch at a time to fill the profile again. So that would mean at a quarter inch a day, I would water about every fourth day. And if you just then, now you can set up your clock on your sprinkler system to do exactly that and for your veggie garden. And so then you're going to kind of be pretty good. Now, where does that fall apart? It falls apart when we have a plant that's heavily fruiting, trying to size those fruits. We may actually need a little bit of extra water. And then I have other plants that I maybe know are shallow rooted, and I'm actually putting too much water into the system. And that's why in a larger vegetable garden, I try to advocate that people start to zone so that they have short statured plants together, they have medium statured plants together, they have tall statured plants together, because short plants have shallow roots, medium statured plants have medium type roots, depth, and the tall plants have the deep roots, and you need to add more water less often to a tall plant than you do to a shallow-rooted plant. And so the net effect of that, Brian, creates a situation where we're changing the logic in how we garden rather than randomly put plants in wherever we put plants and then saying, well, how do I water? I don't know how much to water. And so you underwater some and you overwater the others. If you can zone them a little bit more, now I can do that a little bit more effectively. And then if I put on a drip system, then I can actually get to the point where Jim says, yeah, I do have a spreadsheet because I know how much water this dripper puts out, and I can actually calculate quite closely how much water the plant needs, and then all I need to do is hook that up to my computer as well, and it'll do it for me. And I can, you know, sit in the shade of the tree and drink lemonade all day and read the nice books and, you know, go to the pool and do all those fun things that I want to do in the summer rather than out there, you know, stressing out over how much I'm going to water my vegetable garden.
Well, Dan, we've reached the end of our time.
Has it been that soon?
Again. Yeah, again. We've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He's been our guest. And I wanted to make mention of our Alternascapes tour that's happening up here in Logan. It's this Friday, Saturday, June 23rd, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And it's $5. And you get to go around, and there are 9 residential gardens in the central Logan area featuring unique landscaping and gardening areas. And you'll learn about conserving water and other sources while adding beauty to your landscape. And you can search for Alternascapes Tour Logan or go to the Cache County Extension Office. or Saturday morning at the gardener's booth, Master Gardener's booth at the Gardener's Market to get your tickets. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Thanks for joining us.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.